You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 21st, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, and for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rupa Maria, co-author of Inflamed, Deep Medicine, and The Anatomy of Injustice. Meanwhile, reports of increased frustration with cinema increase as the Biden administration reportedly plans to isolate her after her opposition to raising taxes on corporations and the wealthy remains steadfast. So Republican representation in the Democratic Party matters. And in Manchin land, a report says that he's considering leaving the Democratic Party, which Manchin later denied, after likely leaking that information as a way to say, these negotiations better go my way or else. So let's not take that threat too seriously. I mean, how could he get all the attention that he craves if he's in the GOP? Third time's the charm on voting legislation? Not so much. For the third time, Republicans in the Senate have blocked voting rights, a voting rights bill, this time an even further watered-down version. So, newsflash, they'll block it all. Filibuster reform now. The FDA has authorized booster shots for Moderna and J&J COVID vaccines for more vulnerable populations and has also greenlit mixing and matching booster shots, which could provide better immunity, particularly for the J&J recipients. And the White House is anticipating the approval of the Pfizer vaccine for children ages 5 to 11 shortly, this time with smaller doses and needles, and through pediatricians, not pharmacies and shot sites. And a reminder that global vaccine inequity remains a massive issue, and vaccine intellectual property still needs to be waived. And lastly, Bolivian authorities claim to have connected the mercenaries behind the successful assassination, if you want to call it that, geez, of Haitian, apparently I just did, of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse to an attempt on leftist presidential candidate Luis Arce's life. The plot thickens in that story. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Sam is out on Thursday, as he is every Thursday these days, and I'm here to guide you through this day in news. On the reconciliation front, not much has changed. Not much has changed, although reports are saying that Biden is taking an increased role in negotiations, which begs the question, why was his role not more prominent early on?
Yeah, now that we're at about half the $3.5 trillion, he's decided to get involved. Thanks, Sleepy Joe.
He was a little bit worried about the bill falling apart entirely, I'd imagine, and my guess is he had some internal number within the administration where if it dipped below that, then he would get involved, or if it threatened some of the things that he actually cares about. But the reality is that if they had gotten out in front of this a while ago, if there were coordinated campaigns against these psychos, Manchin and Sinema, then potentially we would have been able to avoid some of these things. But right now, they're running the show, and so it's a bit past due that Biden get involved at the 11th hour. So we're going to take a bit of a turn and talk a little bit about the confirmation hearings for Rahm Emanuel, former mayor of Chicago, former notorious member of the Obama administration who was virulently against the more leftist members of the Democratic Party pushing for single-payer health care.
Pro-finance, anti-left.
Yeah, one of the most reprehensible members of the Democratic Party, but because he has lent his support to Biden and the ilk that surround Joe Biden, they have to reward him because politics are transactional for some reason.
This Rahm is indicative of a lot of Democrats in leadership, frankly.
Yes, but he's a particularly villainous flavor and much more public about it. And of course, he was the mayor of Chicago. And so he made a lot of decisions there, which should be coming up more aggressively in these hearings. But unfortunately for us, Tim Kaine is in the membrane. Tim Kaine's in the brain. And Matt may sing at some point.
Tim Kaine,
no!
Tim Kaine in the membrane. Tim Kaine in the brain!
It's a drop now.
Every muscle in my body is, like, atrophying or it's in. Ugh.
Watch Hillary examine the terrain. Watch her campaign with her man, Tim Kaine.
No! No! Anyway, thanks. Here is Tim Kaine speaking to Rahm Emanuel in his confirmation hearings to be U.S. ambassador to Japan. And what Tim Kaine chose to do here, Rahm Emanuel, of course, of the same kind of group that Tim Kaine is in the Democratic Party, which is why Hillary Clinton selected him to be her vice president, didn't work out so well. Here he is running interference for Emanuel, who helped cover up the murder of then 17-year-old Laquan McDonald at the hands of Chicago police. And to add an extra layer to this story and how reprehensible it is that this man is continuing to get legitimacy in the Democratic Party and in power, these hearings yesterday were 7 years to the day after that white city police officer murdered Laquan McDonald, and Rahm Emanuel didn't release body cam footage of that murder despite repeated protests and calls for 400 days as he tried to cover up what happened. But here's how Tim Kaine frames that in the midst of confirmation hearings.
Mr. McDonald, because what a tragedy. And I was a mayor, and every day in cities, beautiful things happen and tragic things happen. And that's the case in any city. And you can't be a mayor, especially of a city like Chicago, without picking up some scar tissue on the way. But your description of what you learned along the way, that the levels of distrust that some in communities feel toward people in power, toward politicians, toward police, I had to learn and then relearn those lessons often in my time as the mayor of a majority African-American city.
Stop it.
And I'm sure...
The problem is the distrust they feel, or the reason they feel the distrust.
Yeah.
Why I'd be where I would draw that concern.
Right. Well, no, the distrust is earned for everybody else. But for me, you know, I have to just deal with it.
I didn't realize how much you people distrust the cops after they killed
it's
people.
It's so weird.
Suppress the evidence.
But a pretty good example of the cognitive dissonance that some of these more right-wing Democrats have when it comes to their own role in systemic racism.
And it's a wish. It's a wish that people trusted the cops so much that they could just get away with stuff like that.
Right. Do we have a little bit more of that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Then Chicago is a much bigger city than Richmond, Virginia. Those lessons were challenging and painful for you during your entire tenure, but you served in an admirable way. I want to just ask you.
It was challenging and painful for Rahm Emanuel, I'm sure, as he raked in all that cash and he gentrified the entire city and he backed up the police force with complete fealty. So, like, that's not a ringing endorsement, Tim Kaine, that he basically, he had scar tissue that he should be able to get away with for some reason. Because
you look into Tim Kaine's history, honestly.
Yeah, exactly, right? The fact that he sees himself in this situation. Officer Jason Van Dyke fired his weapon 16 times at Laquan McDonald in 2014. October 20th, as I mentioned yesterday, was 7 years to the day. It took 400 days for Rahm Emanuel to release that body cam footage after activists took to the streets countless times. Not only that, the city of Chicago forced the McDonald family to sign an NDA in order to even see the dashboard, the dash cam footage, the body cam footage. I forget which one it was, I'm sorry, of his murder. Which means that Rahm Emanuel's defense of this was like, I didn't see it before. If you weren't aware of this footage, why were you so concerned concerned enough that you made his family sign an NDA in order for them to see the footage and make a case against the Chicago Police Department. And it's not like the ambassador to Japan is some massive position, right? Like, I'm not worried about what Rahm Emanuel is going to do in Japan, even though, oddly, he's coming out and saying, I'm going to use this to pressure China. Very nice. Thank you. We can use you as the cog in the Cold War consensus that the Biden administration and Chuck Schumer and the Republicans in particular are trying to pursue. It's not that. It's the fact that he's been given this legitimacy and continues to be so, to get this legitimacy because he has connections and fundraising ability and money and power in the Democratic Party. If the Democrats want to say that Black Lives Matter and they want to use that for fundraising, do not give people like this, at the bare minimum, more legitimacy and more power, right? Of course, they're not going to reform the filibuster for police reform. They're just going to let voting rights and police accountability go by the wayside in that area. So I've already given up on that for the moment. But at the very least, you don't need to reward individuals like this. And yet they're doing it anyway. So what is their commitment to racial justice and holding police accountable in this country? Because they're not showing it except for kneeling in kente cloth. And I'm sick of the falseness of it.
No, this is why it's good that we actually see what they do when they have the ability to exercise power, because all that stuff is just marketing for campaigns. They don't have any commitment to it. They have commitment to people like Rahm Emanuel, who acted in a way that, frankly, a lot of them would have acted if they were mayor of Chicago, and they frankly recognize that.
We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be joined by Rupa Maria, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and co-author of Inflamed, Deep Medicine, and the Anatomy of Injustice. We will be right back. We are back, And we are joined on the road with Rupa Maria, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and co-author of Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. Rupa, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate you being here.
Thank you. I'm sitting outside my hospital. This is the best place to be unmasked with you today.
I appreciate that. So thank you for your flexibility here. And I can't wait to talk about your book because there's so much there. And you really deal with and grapple with these large questions about the social roots of poor health, and particularly the capitalist and colonial roots of that, which we just, it's not a conversation that is had generally in the United States, and it's especially, or at all, and it's especially relevant in the midst of COVID because we're dealing with these kinds of pathogens that, you know, come from different species and climate change that stems from it as well. So I guess let's start with the current pandemic that we're dealing with. How does what we're currently all experiencing fit into your larger thesis?
So what we're looking at in the book, Raj Patel and I, is we are looking at how the roots of the problems that we're seeing, not just with COVID, which is in its worst form, an inflammatory experience, but all the diseases I treat in the hospital as a physician at UCSF, from cardiovascular disease to cancer to Alzheimer's to diabetes, all of these diseases that are the hallmark of modern industrialized societies are diseases where chronic inflammation is playing a major role in the development and the expression of these diseases. And what we now understand is that inflammation is the body's response to damage or the threat of damage. And this damage can come from things that seem as innocuous as student debt. It can come from things like racist police violence or intergenerational trauma, or, you know, having to work the night shift, not having autonomy in your workspace. So these kinds of damages affect our body in ways that drive inflammatory disease. And in order to have a difference in health outcomes, we have to start restructuring the society around us so that the body can stop being in this state of chronic inflammation. And we see it disproportionately, these diseases disproportionately impact Black, Brown, Indigenous people, but also the working class. And so what COVID is showing us is what, you know, what we've known for a long time is that capitalism, and especially the combination of colonialism and capitalism, have really driven the onset of these and the expansion of these diseases.
So, I mean, you mentioned the racial disparities and the divisions in the way that COVID infections and deaths and illness has manifested itself. And often in the news, they'll talk about those disparities, but not the underlying reason for that, which is inextricably connected to class and the coercion of returning to work in many instances in the midst of this pandemic. Talk a little bit about how that revealed itself in the past 2 years.
Well, you can see it, you know, in the midst of the Delta surge here in California, we were watching as families were being cattle prodded to send their children back to school when we had wildfires. And the strategy to keep the children safe, you know, unvaccinated children, was to open up windows and to ventilate and for masking. And unfortunately, that's not possible when the AQI, the air quality index in the Bay Area, has been up to 250 or unhealthy or hazardous for human health, especially children who breathe more. And so the coinciding crises of climate change and the pandemic really show us how we need to have systems level analysis of what's happening and systems level solutions. So masking and vaccination are important, but they won't get at what's driving the underlying disease spread. And that is the desperation of the working class, and also the desperation that has been manufactured in our society for Black, Brown, and Indigenous people. And so when we understand that these expressions of disease are actually a very natural reaction to those structures, then we can start to really address things upstream and say, okay, well, if we want different outcomes, let's get different structures.
Right. And so I want to return to that concept of inflammation because, of course, it's so important to your book as both a way to look at our bodies and how they're reacting to the world and how that's disproportionate along a lot of those lines that you mentioned, but also as a metaphor for our world system and capitalism as constructed and in general, and the colonial shades of that, and how that's what that system is going through or undergoing right now in inflammation. Take us through the connectivity. Yeah.
Yes. So these things are related, and how medicine fails, as Western medicine, how it fails is it doesn't understand the relationships between these things, and that these relationships have been invisibilized for centuries. So what we practice right now, by treating individuals, by not understanding how these things are related, it makes us actually ineffective at, you know, addressing the rising rates of diabetes and cancer. I just saw a 34-year-old woman with widely spread colon cancer, and this has become increasingly common in my 20 years of practicing medicine. So the mindset that led to the colonization of this land, which separated people from nature, which separated, you know, white folks from other folks, which separated, you know, enforce these false dichotomies of mind and body, this Cartesian Enlightenment era errors that we're still living with, are a part of what was needed to colonize other people's lands and extract the wealth and labor from those lands, in order to, you know, benefit the European, you know, overlords at that time. And the overlords have changed. So in India, you have, you know, different overlords, but the colonial structures are still in place. So that is not really a liberated society, you could say, or nation. And so,
yes. Oh, go on.
Yeah, sorry. And so that these structures that were advanced 600 years ago created a severance of people from the web of life and from everything that keeps us healthy. And so the cause of climate change is the same kind of cause that we're seeing in these inflammatory diseases. I mean, it is not a metaphor when you look at how we farm under capitalist society with these industrial farming techniques that literally expose the soil to more, you know, oxidation of the soil and eating up a stable carbon in the soil. The soil is literally inflamed. So it's important to understand these biological processes are the body's natural way to respond to damage. And so it's not like our bodies are out, you know, they're responding incorrectly. They're responding correctly to damage. So if we want it to stop, we have to stop the damage. And that is literally transforming our world. It's time to transform, the way our society is structured.
Yeah. So I guess we can talk a little bit about that underlying structure, and capitalism and colonialism in general, and how, as currently envisioned and structured, and I just think maybe it's just inextricable, the systems of colonialism and capitalism as ways to serve the West / global North. How has that produced the inflammation that you describe?
Well, you know, when this land was colonized several hundred years ago, it was militaries, missionaries, and medics who did that work. And so it's not a surprise then when we look at, you know, why are there such health disparities between white and black women, let's say, in maternity outcomes? Well, this is part of the structure of how medicine was set up in these places. And it's and the entire architecture of medicine is set up in that way. So in order to, you know, when that medicine is also then driven through capitalist aims, like right now in California, the COVID response has been really guided by healthcare executive lobbyists instead of our frontline nurses and doctors. Things that we wished we had this whole time, we still don't have in the ways that we want. Because the workers are not determining our policy. It's these healthcare executive lobbyists. And these healthcare systems are making record profits at a time when our nurses are in trash bags, you know, just trying to, you know, get through this pandemic, safely. And so if we valued worker safety, if we valued patient safety, if we valued children's safety, we would be emphasizing the agendas of those carers, of the people who are doing the care. If we valued farmer or farm worker safety, so the very people who are critical to the functioning of our society have not been setting the agenda on how things happen with this pandemic. And that is the sort of top-down structure of a colonial architecture, of a capitalist colonial architecture. And it just shows that then the brunt of the suffering will constantly be upon those workers, upon those people. And that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable for our children to be carrying this risk. It's unacceptable for doctors and nurses to be getting sick and dying from COVID. And so that's really this moment in history is a great time to focus in on why are things the way they are. We talk about structural determinants of health, but we do not talk about how those structures came to be. And that's what we do in this book, in our book, Inflamed.
Right. I mean, this is a bit of an aside, but like one of the starkest examples of what I've seen in the pandemic is just like the shortages and the reporting on the shortages of hospital beds or ventilators. And there's the reporting on what's happening, but the underlying system there is that these for-profit hospitals deliberately cut the number of beds because they want to make the profits more efficient. They want to be more efficient and make money, and empty beds like that's burning cash, right?
Exactly. It's the same concept of like you pay your firefighters to be ready for when there's a fire. So many hospitals have closed in rural communities because of this capitalist consolidation. It's a terrible idea to have those values running your healthcare system, which is why we're pushing for AB 1400 in California to get single payer, to get private health insurance out of California so that we can be done with the financial abuse, both doctors and patients and nurses. We could be done with the financial abuse that we're living through. And then understanding that financial abuse, the medical debt that most Americans carry, is a part of what's driving our inflammation. Debt itself is an independent cause of inflammatory disease. And so if you eliminated debt in, you know, for example, like payday loans in the United States, if you eliminated this toxic financial tool, you would directly improve health outcomes. And so that is, you know, we saw it with the public smoking ban. It took 20 years to fight the tobacco industry to get one like public smoking ban. And it's had tremendous impacts on lowering the rates of fatal heart attacks and strokes. And so that is what we need to be doing on a societal level.
Right. So, I mean, you all right? Okay.
It's the parking police in San Francisco.
I gotcha. So the concept of kind of atomizing these different concepts and sectioning off. Sectioning off elements of or the manifestation of harm or inflammation from those larger concepts. You write about how it's like modern or Western healthcare that's kind of individualized healthcare in and of itself, and so I think that's indicative of a lot of larger problems that we see in capitalism. The extracting these like separate little examples of it from the whole. I'm just wondering if you could expand on how that reveals itself in medicine in the United States and in the West in particular.
Yes. So this whole concept of individual health is something that we really challenge in this book, that atomization of individuals, the focus on individuals for the blaming them for their illness or looking to them for their own healing is part of the legacy of separating us from one another and from the web of life that is critical for supporting our health. And so what we discuss in our book is that health is actually an emergent phenomenon of systems working well within systems. And so that is that we can't actually look to be healthy if we've ignored an aspect of the system. For example, we can't hope to vaccinate the global north and leave the global south behind and not expect a variant to come and, you know, bite us in the butt, which is exactly what happened. And so it is a critical time to look at how capitalism has organized our understanding of our bodies and ourselves and our world around us, and how it is to our detriment that we follow that cosmology and mentality, and that there are much richer and better cosmologies already out there that support greater biodiversity and consequently greater health. And we see that with indigenous communities who are living with their traditions intact. For example, the Yanomami and the Amazon, they have the greatest biodiversity inside their body through their gut microbiome. And we know that the gut microbiome protects against inflammatory disease. They do not suffer the inflammatory diseases that we do. They also steward the greatest biodiversity outside their body. So what is it about their cosmology? Not that we all want to go, you know, live back in huts or, you know, be separated from the cultures that we love in today's world. But what can we learn from the indigenous communities around us that have stewarded and continue to steward the greatest amount of healthful practices, both for the planet and for their own bodies?
So, I mean, then I think that your critique of Western and modern medicine is one that I share, but it's like a little bit different than, and obviously because you work in medicine, you can speak to this, than say some of the holistic critiques that we'll hear. And I'm sympathetic to those as well, but I think what that misses, right? It's not, you know, an Eastern medicine versus Western thing. It's how is medicine reflective of the systems that we live under, I would imagine that very few of your colleagues even think to ask that question.
Yes, it's very true. And I would say that what, you know, while I do support people, you know, meditating, and there's a health benefit to doing yoga and to eating well, to eating organic if possible, I want that to be available to everybody, not just people who are wealthy and not just people who look to their own individual healing, but that we should have the opportunity for everyone to breathe clean air, for everyone to drink unpolluted water, for everyone to have access to healthful foods, nutritious foods. And we can't have that in a capitalist society. It just won't exist. It cannot exist. And so I hold the holistic health movement responsible for continuing the same kind of capitalist atomization of the individual and focus on the individual as opposed to the systems level healing. So I call what our analysis, I call that like really holistic health, understanding how history and lines of power are shaping the world around us, and our bodies are responding to those shapes. And if those shapes are damaging, which they are for all of us, the outcome we'll get is inflammation. If those shapes are healing, the outcome we'll get is better health. And so I look for that, you know, that holistic analysis incorporating history and lines of power so that we can all move together in solidarity to create health.
So then I guess let's talk a little bit more about how to expand some of these systems. I mean, medical innovation, I never thought of it this way, but you write about how it's basically not a rising tide that lifts all boats, essentially. We can both celebrate medical innovation and also see it as kind of working within that same system that you discuss. So talk a little bit about what you've experienced in your field.
So I would never want to throw away Western science or Western medicine, and I want to make that clear. A lot of our book is based on weaving together Western science with other ways of understanding. We need to expand who is the peer in peer review. We need to allow more systems of knowledges into to complicate and deepen our understanding of how to be effective as healing in the healing arts. We need to go back to understanding that our work can be healing, and we're not just biomedical technicians of, you know, broken body parts. We need to get back to learning how to listen to our patients. So I definitely celebrate and love the advances we see in medicine. I do completely and wholeheartedly reject the logic of domination of colonialism that has shaped how medicine works. And that is why I work with many different groups around the world, and especially here in Turtle Island, to decolonize medicine. So we're doing this work at the Deep Medicine Circle. Everyone can go check it out, deepmedicinecircle.org, where we are working with farmers and healers and doctors and lawyers and artists to advance a system of food and medicine that have always been coexistent, to really create new models of what healing and health can look like from community, and also to partner with other groups around the country who are doing this, like the Miniwichoni Health Circle in Standing Rock, where I was really blessed to be invited out to help serve. But it is these innovations that are coming from our communities struggle that are really on, you know, individual obsessions of, you know, diets or my.
I think we're losing you a little bit. It might be back. Okay, I think you're back. Yes, you might have cut out just a little bit. So I apologize if I'm repeating anything, but I appreciated your mention of Standing Rock. We did an interview and reckoned with a lot of the climate elements that are of course important to understanding the consequences of capitalism, and it makes sense that that would be a place that you would be kind of attracted to seeing as a starting point for a lot of like these new ways to view medicine, specifically in the United States, and practice it. And you mentioned indigenous communities. In the United States, there are enormous health disparities with indigenous communities as well. And the way that the response has been, or the reaction to the extreme system of colonialization and domination that we've inflicted upon indigenous communities in the United States has been, oh, well, you know, like the racist trope. They're alcoholics or whatever. Like, I mean, those are, that's a clear manifestation of this very dynamic that you lay out in your book.
Yes. And we should know that, you know, Hitler came to the United States to study what the United States did to indigenous people to make his, you know, final solution for his undesirable people in Europe. And so this system of violence and genocide that continues in you know, this area in the North America is continuing to wreak havoc on the bodies and communities of indigenous people and their lands. And so the work, when you see, you know, Winona LaDuc and our, you know, warriors out stopping line three, you see that people are very deeply concerned with public health, the health of the water, the health of the future, the health of the people there. These are public health measures, and actually they're the most effective ones. The indigenous pipeline resistance has been the most effective source of cutting greenhouse gases in North America. And so let's follow what's effective if we're serious about climate science. And that really requires following indigenous leadership.
Right. I wanted to expand on another point that you touched on, but about the concept of how, on the micro level, Western/modern medicine tends to separate, like, okay, problem with the head, problem with your lungs, problem with your colon, whatever. And how that is, I never thought about this way until reading what you wrote, but that is so reflective of the systems of atomization under capitalism, and how that reflects in different ways. And talk a little bit about how you saw those patterns repeating in your own profession.
Well, we organized the book. The book is called Inflamed: Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. And we organized it like an anatomical textbook, starting out with, you know, the immune system, going to the, you know, cardiovascular system, the respiratory system. We take people through a tour. And by the end of the book, we're showing how even those concepts of, you know, atomizing the body into these different systems makes no sense. The gut brain microbiota axis is what keeps us healthy and modulates our inflammatory response. So the stress response, the inflammatory response itself, is delocalized not only within our bodies, but it's being shaped by the millions of microbes that live inside us. So even our concepts of self must be challenged by what we know in science. And science is so much farther ahead of where medicine will go, and even our understandings of who we are. So it's an exciting time to see what microbiology has taught us, what ecology is teaching us, and how that there's an intersection between these things and traditional ecological knowledge in our indigenous communities, which is why the work of scientists and and in traditional ecological knowledge keepers is so vital right now, because there is a beautiful cultural intersection, a way of knowing intersection. And that's why opening ourselves to more peers and peer review is so critical at this moment. But yes, like there is, you know, our neurological system is being trained in its development by the microbes in our gut. So if we don't have those healthy microbes in our gut,
Well, we may have lost Rupa here.
I'm going to take a little break.
Yeah, let's take a quick break and we will try to get her back. One second. We are back, and appreciate you sticking with us, everybody. Hopefully the connection's a little bit better. So I guess I'm forgetting where we left off, but I wanted to talk a little bit about pollution too, because that's something that is like one of the most obvious manifestations of inflammation, and of course our water sources as well. Flint, Michigan, and a variety of other cities throughout the country, and the construction of pipelines is something we touched on a little bit earlier. But people can easily draw those connections, and I think it might be a useful place to start when trying to get some people to think a little bit harder about capitalism as how it informs our medicine and our health and how it inflames us and the world. So pollution as connected to our bodies. Talk a little bit about that and how that fits into the larger thesis.
Well, air pollution, for example, affects every part, every system of our bodies. The particles, particulate matter that come through toxic industries end up affecting our brains, affecting the development of Alzheimer's disease, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancers. We know all this now. We also know that particulate matter also can carry viruses on it. So there's concern for how influenza spreads, how COVID has been spreading. And now with these wildfires that rage in California in the West Coast, that matter also, some of that smoke, especially when it's in their rural-urban interface, is highly toxic to breathe. And the thing that we have to know is that we most of these communities who are disproportionately impacted by poor air, they don't get a choice for the air that they breathe. That choice is made for them by the industries. And so just like I mentioned with the tobacco ban, that was effective. It worked. It improved health outcomes. The only people that hurt was the tobacco industry. It's the same thing with the fossil fuel industry. It's time to ban fossil fuel inputs in our food supply, all the toxic chemicals and pesticides that damage the soil microbiology. So just as I mentioned, the gut microbiome was so critical for our health and inflammation, the soil microbiome is the same. And I drove through California Central Valley on Indigenous Peoples Day, and there was a windstorm, and we are turning California into a dust bowl. All that soil was aerosolized. It was just, it was so sad to see that. And it's happening because of the agricultural industries that are poisoning the soil and damaging the health of the water, the soil, and the air all at the same time. In addition, they use unbelievably toxic labor practices where they degrade the value and dignity of our, you know, farm working community. And we've seen that, you know, with COVID, those are the people who are most heavily hit. So what COVID has shown us, and this is, it really did prove the thesis of our book, is that the more our bodies are shaped through social oppression, the more inflamed we become. Mm-hmm. The people who are coming into the hospital with severe COVID are people whose bodies have been really shaped through social oppression, whether that's class, race, gender, you know, all the dynamics, all the axes. And so in order to have a body that can respond with a healthful response, you need to have a healthy world around. And it's time to put those industries that are causing poor health, put them aside. They should not be running and dictating public health. And they are.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm going to ask if you could talk a little bit more about labor in general and its effect on health, because that's something in the United States where we have zero public awareness on. Something that's actually, it's increased during COVID, right? Because the undervaluing of labor and the extreme conditions that people had to work under, I think we're seeing an unprecedented, in the past few decades, uprising of labor consciousness, which is really important. But beyond COVID, the effect of exploitative labor practices on health and how that has shown itself in your work and then also what you wrote about.
Yeah, so it really is a time for a care revolution around the world. It is a time for workers to withhold their labor, if you know, as we can, and work with mutual aid groups to get us through general strikes, to get us through resistance to participating in a system that demands our exposure and demands our degradation and our poor health. And so what we see is that worker collectives, where workers are in charge of the decisions that they make in their labor, in the places where they work, when they own and really are directly benefiting from their labor and the practices, those people, the more autonomous those spaces are, the better health outcomes you see. And that's not a shock, but it's a consciousness that's been really suppressed in the United States since the 1950s, and it needs to grow because that is how we will get better health outcomes. You know, there was an amazing study that came out of Alberta, Canada, that showed that, you know, Indigenous people that spoke their own languages were protected against diabetes, controlling for all other things. And so it's not just about diet and health, like diet and exercise, which is how doctors will talk about these diseases of lifestyle. These aren't diseases of lifestyle. These are diseases of capitalism. These are diseases of systems of domination that are impacting our bodies. So those communities that spoke their native languages had lower rates of diabetes. So understanding who we are and having a greater sense of autonomy and self-directedness really improves our health and well-being. And this is not rocket science. This is an idea that's been around since 1848, when Rudolf Virchow was saying the same thing about German imperialism at the time, you know, where Europe was encountering a similar uprising of labor consciousness, where the working class was tired of being abused by the bourgeoisie. So it's important to understand historically where we are and how to move things forward for greater health.
Yeah, and I guess lastly, or nearing the end, because I know you have to go, but I'm curious how your analysis and understanding differed, because we talked a lot about the United States, but there were other examples given, of course, about the UK. It stands out, the disparity in, I believe it was infant mortality or mothers dying when giving birth. Was there something particularly extreme about the United States' inflammation as compared to other countries in the global north?
We have the greatest burden of inflammatory disease. We have the shortest life expectancy. We spend the most on healthcare. So those, you know, it's the system is being driven for profit. It's not being driven for health. And that's what, you know, really needs to shift and change if we want to see better health outcomes. But you find these same patterns in every society that's been shaped through colonial capitalist cosmologies. You find the same outcomes in India. You find these same disparities there. And we talk about that in the book. And it's important to understand that it's not about saying, oh, okay, well, the British are gone from India, so things are fine, when the architecture of the society has been set up and it's still run that way. So that's, you know, what we really need to take aim at is how do we retool, how do we restructure in order to get health? Because health will not be possible if we keep, you know, I can give as much insulin as you want in the hospital, but I'm not going to affect the rates of diabetes until we start restructuring our world.
Right. Well, I really appreciate your time today. We had someone write in called Dank Uger. Very funny name. Amazing guest. Please have her back. If you write a new book, or just in general, we'd love to have you. Rupa Maria, Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and co-author of Inflamed, Deep Medicine and the Anatomy of Injustice. Rupa, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your close reading and your great questions. You take care.
You too. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk about Jeff Bezos and also wrap things up. We are back. We are back from our break. Back from the break. All right, so we are going to have a little bit of fun here, even before the fun half. So if you're watching us on Peacock, there's more of this.
Yeah.
On our show, in the fun half.
I just want to comment on the interview briefly, like just to look at this as, you know, not an individual issue, because I did I used to be a researcher for Vice News, and we did a episode on food, and so I had to research topics on for the panel
right.
to discuss on food, and the amount the rise in obesity in America is clearly something that is not just people decided they were going to start not caring about their weight. It's clearly something that comes from our agriculture and food systems, because in 1980, I think there was like two or three states that had an obesity rate above like 20%, and now it's basically every state. And there's been a little bit of change to the methodology there, but not enough to describe that massive change. And it's clear that this is the way that
but why not blame the individual?
Yeah, they definitely don't blame the food capitalists.
Yeah, right. And so that of course obscures exactly the dynamics that she's trying to say. So I mean, that's a great point. I wish I asked that. But now let's just have a little bit of fun talking about Jeff Bezos. Although this clip oddly makes me kind of sad. It's sad.
No, I'm very sad after this clip.
Yes.
It's funny. It's like I can't stop laughing at it. And when I'm not watching it, I want to watch it again because of how bad it is. But when I start watching it, I'm like, oh, this is horrible. Why
right.
am I watching this?
So, yes, it's a train wreck. It's like a dark comedy distilled into a small clip. Jeff Bezos returned from space again. And he had William Shatner of Star Trek fame, who is 90 years old, which I did not realize.
Star Trek's an old show.
Yeah, and he looks great. Bezos had him on the aircraft as a way to create publicity, but Shatner was excited by this experience because who wouldn't be emotional and in awe when you go to space and see the globe? That's like, I mean, but it's another day at the office for this psychopath Bezos.
But I mean, yeah, Shatner, just a hero of many children. I mean, I didn't really watch Star Trek, but as far as like the imaginative space of space
yes.
itself, you know, this is a guy who saw, I mean, 90 years old, you've seen a pretty amazing slice of American history with regards to those, particularly space travel and NASA and stuff like that, and you helped people imagine that. And so you would imagine, like, you would have something kind of profound to say after going up and down in basically a very elaborate hot air balloon.
Right. The leading man on one of the two biggest sci-fi star franchises, Star Trek and Star Wars, comes with Jeff Bezos. And anybody with a pulse who was able to give someone like that, an icon, an opportunity to actually be in space when he's known for being a part of a franchise that takes place in space and had such a cultural impact on so many people, they would be humbled. They would be interested in their experience. Not Jeff.
Not only is it different than what you thought, it happened so quickly.
Well done! First time.
You know what my...
Get out of here, people!
The impression I had that I never expected to happen is you shooting up.
Oh my God.
And
give me
this
champagne bottle. Come here. I want one. I want to hear this. Here. You want a little of this? Hey.
No. Oh my God. Dudes rock.
Oh, my God. Oh, and Shatner.
The champagne showers have begun. Smiles all around.
We never get to find out what Shatner, the impression Shatner never expected to have was. We just never get to find out.
He's crying. He's crying about how beautiful it was. And Jeff's like, God, do I have to keep...
This is
I like, want one! Yeah!
That's like the writing style of like Grand Theft Auto like franchise. Like, look at this dumb oligarch that like can't prioritize between hearing a national treasure speak about a transcendent moment he just had that you included him on so he could basically have it. And you need to... I mean, frankly, not even spray it that well. Champagne twice. I mean, normal guy.
I mean, it's the narcissism of it, of course, is what's jarring. But like you mentioned this before the show too, just respect for your elders.
Yeah, this makes me want to call my grandparents.
Again, he's 90 years old, and you've got to just listen to him talk about his experience a little bit there. It's unbelievable. But I mean, he just wants to revel in his own glory of his own creation, Jeff Bezos.
Yeah. People are saying that Shatner does get the opportunity to go on later, but I think it speaks for itself.
I definitely
do. In the middle of saying the one thing I was not expecting to experience, and then Jeff is like, "Oh, I want to hear this." I want to hear
yeah!
this.
I
mean, Jeff Bezos shouldn't be allowed to command this amount of sort of economic priorities of the globe anyway, but certainly not if this is the way he's going to appreciate it, like a 13-year-old.
Yes, and obviously, but I think we're going to cancel Jeff Bezos after this, don't you think, Matt?
Yeah, I think this is the last straw.
This is the last straw. You had a bunch of chances, and yeah. Now with William Shatner standing right there, to disrespect him like this, now I don't mess with you anymore.
Being one of the largest scale coercers of labor in the world, I mean, that almost enough in and of itself, Mr. Bezos, but you disrespect Shatner like this.
Yeah, I mean, I was willing to give you another chance, but no longer. All right, folks, with that... I hope that everybody enjoyed that clip and that interview. So, Peacock audience, we will have to say adieu goodbye? Wait, which is the right one to say?
Auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen, right. Nah, I'm sure we butchered that as well. Could say aloha, because then you can substitute that, and it's hello and goodbye, and you'll be seeing us tomorrow. Sam will be back for Casual Friday. But for now, we will say goodbye to you, and if you enjoyed this program and you're watching us on Peacock, you can check out the fun half of our program on our YouTube page and streaming everywhere. More clips like that crazy Jeff Bezos one that we just saw there. See you tomorrow. But if you're sticking around, off to the fun half. So yeah, that was incredible. we were like, should we do a substantive Joe Manchin clip, at the end of the show?
No, I'm boring.
No, I'm sick of talking about him.
Yeah, I mean, we know that the thing is like, Psaki gave away the game when she said, we still think we'll get a reconciliation package, not the reconciliation package. We knew this was going to happen, so we can just talk about Bezos and how billionaires are bad.
Yeah. All right. So, everybody watching here, if you enjoy what we do, please become a member. Join the Majority Report. Helps us. Helps us do the show every single day, 2.5 hours plus, particularly when Sam's around. The plus plus. And a variety of other things. We're going to be taking your calls, 646-257-3920. But first, Matt, which one of you is going to promote your show first?
I like how you just said
You spoke first. All right. You get to talk about doomed.
You refer to us as if you would refer to, like, I don't know, deer, like a pack of deer, the same word for both.
Oh, yeah. Matt.
All right. So tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern time at youtube.com/Matt Binder, and then later as a podcast at doomedcast.com, I will be having on film director Zeb Haradon. He will be talking about his 2005 documentary, Still Waiting for Nasara. Now, if you follow me on YouTube or Twitch, we watched the movie together on this past Tuesday. And if you're wondering, and if you didn't watch it, you're probably wondering, why are we talking about a 2005 movie? And that's because it's relevant today. Nasara is a conspiracy theory where people basically believe that there's a set of laws that were supposed to go into, they were supposed to be enacted in the U.S. under the Bush administration that would have completely wiped all of their debts clean. They would have financial freedom, no problems at all. Everything is great. No mortgage to pay, no credit card debts, et cetera, et cetera. Other things too, like the abolishment of the IRS is involved, so no more taxes. But Bush orchestrated 9/11 and then the Iraq War to make this not happen. And to this day, people still believe this conspiracy theory. And it got wrapped up into QAnon. There's a whole subsection of QAnon believers who believe in Nasara. And it'll be quite an adventure talking about this. There's aliens involved, lizard people involved, the Illuminati, a right-wing conspiracy where Bill Clinton is somehow a good guy. It's a lot. You guys will enjoy this one.
Wow. That is a bold right-wing conspiracy theory.
It's the conspiracy to end all conspiracies. Matt,
right.
What's happening over on Left Reckoning? Did you have your show last night?
We did. Bronco Marchetich on to...
He's awesome.
Yeah, we discussed... I recently reread his book, Yesterday's Man, on Joe Biden, How Joe Biden Sucks. And it's the book that you would want to read to sort of understand why we've ended up where we are, where we can't actually function, or they can't actually function as a party and get an agenda passed. Not actually super surprising. So we talk about that. We talk about how one of the definite benefits of having Democrats' power is it sort of demonstrates how awful they are, and they can't just fundraise and pretend. And they're almost more dangerous than opposition, which maybe even like some of the Russiagators could agree with at this point. But anyway, we talked about that, how this is not a surprise, and a little bit of Joe's history. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning for the post game.
Brandon, hello.
Hello. Sorry for being tardy. My internet had a little bit of a hiccup, but you know, I'm here now.
Okay, well, glad to see you. What's happening over at the discourse?
You know, I just want to say, I'm a big fan of preposition humor, so that really, you know, tickled me in the right place.
Yeah.
So We have a recording this weekend. You know, ideally, we'll have an episode out for all of our lovely listeners by Monday. Hope everyone enjoyed the last one. I mean, it seems like they did. Habana syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
Habana.
Habana?
That's how it's pronounced. I've heard people pronounce it Havana syndrome, but it's actually Habana syndrome.
What about Havana syndrome?
I'm not from the South. Like, I guess I am from the South, but you know, I'm not that far from the South.
All right. Well, I was just saying, you know, next time maybe I go out to dinner and have a little bit too much to drink, I'm calling in sick with Havana syndrome. We'll see if Sam buys it, but I'm just letting you guys know that everybody needs to back me up on this.
Like an NBA syndrome.
I mean, honestly, the entire side of my face was a little bit like hot for 2 days, and I was sure that I had finally been targeted.
Mm. Yeah, like the Russian space laser just hit only on one side of you. They were only able to get that angle.
I mean, yeah, you know, it was the right side, so I think that's like my dominant side, and that's just part of their plan.
Makes sense. Yeah, that's one way to immobilize you. Yeah.
Imbalance.
646-257-3920. See you all in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. 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 Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
You see, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
What?
Come on.
What?
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.